In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Depression, anxiety, anger, envy, and many similar states of being often begin with chronic negative thought patterns. Without conscious effort to stop it, the patterns can lead to a downward emotional spiral. The precise origin of these thoughts seem to still be a mystery to mental health experts. Do our minds naturally generate these thoughts? When and how do the thoughts become voices? Why do the voices attack certain individuals? For the mentally ill, and especially schizophrenics, the voices are known to be vulgar, grotesque, and anti-human, ultimately driving the tormented state of a fragmented mind. This realm is where our guest learned about the real nature of the voices. Our guest, Jerry Marcinski, is a retired, licensed psychotherapist and has studied the thought process of psychotic and criminally insane patients inside the nation's psychiatric institutions. He worked intensely with those patients who were hearing a consistent dialogue and were willing to share in real time what the voices were saying. Marcinski learned the voices warned against telling others about them. The voices appeared to be programmed to torment those they infested. The voices went after those who were emotionally distraught or very traumatized. The voices told patients to kill themselves. In some cases, the voices were the cause of persistent drug addiction. The voices can hide behind the patient's trauma and pain. From this perspective, traditional medicine has failed victims of schizophrenia in treating their mental illness as a chemical imbalance. Meanwhile, there is known neurological damage documented from prescribed psychotropic drug use. The revelation that spiritual warfare can be attributed to certain psychotic conditions isn't necessarily a new concept. However, the renewed understanding that the voices are very likely malevolent spiritual manifestations has begun to change the path and approach of treatment for schizophrenia. We talk about the nature of the voices as separate entities and the treatment with Dr. Marcinski. He was awarded the State of Arizona's Meritorious Service Award and the Pima College Apple Award of Teaching Abnormal Psychology. He holds a BA in psychology from Temple University, a master's degree in counseling from the University of Georgia, and 2 years of study in a PhD psychology program. He's the co-author of the book titled An Amazing Journey into the Psychotic Mind, Breaking the Spell of the Ivory Tower, and currently has a private practice in Arizona. Jerry, welcome to Another News.
Glad to be here.
Your book, An Amazing Journey into the Psychotic Mind, clearly illustrates that our reality isn't what it seems. Humans can decode a very small fraction of this reality. Some of us seem more protected than others from the parasitical entities operating outside of our five-sense awareness. I can't imagine the amount of work you've done to discover the entities behind these voices. Would you please give listeners an overview of your work in state institutions and how you learned about the nature of those afflicted with schizophrenia?
Well, that's a long story. After graduate school, I went to work at one of the biggest psychiatric hospitals on the planet. There were like 10,000 patients there when I arrived. It was like a sea of insanity. And nothing in college or graduate school prepared me for what I was to find there. Well, one thing I hated about psychology is you could not verify what they were teaching you. You know, they'd hand you this textbook full of stuff, and you'd have to just read it and regurgitate it, but you couldn't get into a mental health center. You couldn't get into a state hospital. You couldn't get into the state prisons. You couldn't verify what they were saying. You know, you just had to believe what they were saying and regurgitate it back on a test. So I was very uncomfortable with that because I didn't trust authority as far as I could throw it. I was just kind of raised that way. First crack in the wall that I saw between what they were teaching me and the reality of what was out there was remembering back to one paper that we were ordered to read in abnormal psychology. And basically it said that if two insane people were to have the same delusion, like if both of them believed that they were Joe Biden, one of them would have to switch into something else, Nikita Khrushchev or something else. And I remember reading that, even as a freshman, it was like, that doesn't make any sense. Why would one crazy person have to change his delusion to suit, not to conflict with another one? You know, so I stored that in the back of my head, you know, and fast forward about maybe 9 years later, I was hired at this big major state hospital, and I was doing rounds on the second floor, and I saw a schizophrenic carrying on a conversation with somebody I couldn't see, and it sounded like somebody speaking on a telephone where you could only hear the person speaking, but you couldn't hear the person talking, coming in, you know. So I was curious about what he was talking about, and I tried to sneak up behind him, and he caught me. He turned around, looked at me, and I said, "Hi, I'm Jerry. I haven't seen you here before. Are you new to this unit?" And he said, "Yeah, I just got here a couple of days ago." And I said, "What's your name?" And he said, "I'm Jesus Christ." And I thought back to that paper, and I looked at him straight in the eye, and I said, no, you can't be Jesus Christ because I am. And I sat there wondering, okay, let's see what he's going to do. He thought about it, you know, he sat there, thought about it. And then he looked up at me and said, "Okay, we can both be Jesus Christ." And he strolled off, you know. And I said, "Okay, what else did they lie to me about?" You know. The next crack in the wall I found was they were teaching not only in the programs I was in, but also in psychiatric programs. Mental illness was caused by a chemical imbalance. You know. So I'm like, I was watching the psychiatrist. I'd go to the psychiatrist's office with the patient and watch how they did business. And they would spend maybe 15, 20 minutes talking to the client, you know, and then they'd start prescribing medicines. And I'd go, okay, if it's a chemical imbalance, what's the baseline? What test do you have to test what chemicals are out of balance or by how much? You know, and I didn't never saw one. So finally, I asked one of the psychiatrists, it's like, well, if mental illness is due to a chemical imbalance, what's your test? I mean, what's your baseline? How do you know what's out of balance or by how much? And he goes, oh, the drug companies take care of that for us. We just prescribe the medicines. And I'm like thinking, that's like letting the fox loose in the hen house. What are you thinking? You know, but that's what they were all doing. You know, it was like a dartboard where they just choose a medicine to start with, start the person on that medicine, and then, you know, see how he did and bring him back and either adjust it up or down or add more medicines to it or take him off that medicine and put more medicines on. It was just a medicine game. There was no bottom line. There was no baseline. This was a subjective guessing game. You know, so where did that come from? Turned out that a drug company, Eli Lilly, came up with it when they came out with their drug Prozac. Okay? So they just made it up. You know, so they needed some excuse for why their medicines work because they didn't have any idea for sure. So Lilly just made this up and then printed it. Oh, it's caused by a chemical imbalance. You know, and then the psychiatrist, kind of like the Egyptian priests of old, is we hereby declare that mental illness is caused by a chemical imbalance. And that's what they started teaching in the medical schools. That's what they started teaching in the graduate programs. The bottom line was that the drug companies were making a fortune on selling these drugs. You know, global antipsychotic sales. Now, this is for 2021. They soared to $14.54 billion in 2021 with an estimated profit of $15.5 billion. We're talking billion, not million, in 2022. And the antidepressant market was expected to reach 15.98 billion by 2023. This is all a money game. None of those drugs cured anything. All they did was tamp down symptoms. They didn't fix any mentally ill problem. They did, you know, now they're putting kids on it. Over 7.2 million kids on psychiatric drugs in the United States right now. Okay. That was the second crack in the thing. It's like, and then I saw the research on when I was in graduate school. It was like publish or perish. The instructors had to publish, or they were dinged for it. You know, they didn't get their whatever their permanent status if they didn't publish, or if they didn't publish with students. So they were constantly trying to get with students to publish papers and try to have the student do the work. So they would publish virtually anything. You know, I remembered when they were asking me to do a publication and I wanted to do one on depression. I wanted to contribute something unique. And the professor said, no, don't do that. Just do a quick study and publish it and then just add your tit to the tat. What's that all about? You know, these little ticks kept adding up. Another one where I read a research paper by a major institution on the validity of papers published by universities, psychology departments and universities. They found something like 82% of the results published could not be replicated, right? So it was garbage. Yeah. So the duplicity just kept mounting. I would ask staff, I mean, I'd say, what are the voices? What are these people hearing? Oh, they're just hallucinations, you know. But I noticed that, you know, when the patients were listening to these psychotic voices, they were getting into a lot of trouble. You know, the ones who were listening to the voices were getting into a lot more trouble than the ones who were trying to ignore them or kind of do something against them to try to fight against them. Okay. So I started asking staff, what are these things? Oh, they're just hallucinations. You know, where did that come from? They don't have any studies at all on the voices. Here's the psychiatric mafia and Big Pharma again getting up there and going, we're the authorities. We're the ones telling you these are hallucinations. You know, well, where's the studies? You know, what objective evidence do you have that these things are hallucinations? None. Absolutely none. They hadn't done any studies on these voices at all, and they're the number one symptom in paranoid schizophrenia. They just hereby proclaimed, with the authority invested in them, that these voices were hallucinations and that there was nothing to them. Right. So I found that suspicious and started, while I was at the state hospital, I started asking some of the patients, you know, what are these voices telling you? And they really didn't want to talk about it because there's nothing in it for them. You know, if they tell a counselor or a psychologist that they're hearing voices, then they get sent before the psychiatrist. The psychiatrist adjusts their meds or increases their meds or changes their meds. It's all about meds, you know, nothing else. So the patients didn't want their meds increased. They didn't like those meds and they kept going off them and getting in trouble. You know, those are not abusable meds. Nobody likes them. The side effects are horrific, and they cause permanent neurological damage with extended use. You know, so not only are they curing nothing, they're actually doing neurological damage to these patients if they use them for a long period of time. And they were using them for a long period of time. And then when the toxic effects of those drugs started showing up, and, you know, they had the shaking hands and the darting tongue and the tics and all these symptoms of neurological destruction, then they would give them Cogentin to mask that so they wouldn't experience it while they kept feeding them these psychiatric drugs that were actually poisoning them, you know. I was wanting to know, well, what are these voices they're hearing? And nobody was curious about them except me, you know. Nobody knew anything about them. They all believed that they were hallucinations like they were taught in school. So it took me about a year to figure out how to talk to these guys because the voices themselves did not want anybody talking to them about them. They wanted them to believe that they were hallucinations also, right? And they would tell the patients, they'd say, you talk about us, nobody's going to believe you. They're going to lock you up. You're going to end up in a mental hospital. And that's usually what happened. You know, a son or a daughter starts reporting voices to their mom or dad that they're hearing these voices tell them horrible things to kill themselves. You know, that they're stupid, they're ugly, they're crazy. They're every insult that you could think of is these voices talking to the person, and nobody else can hear them except the victim. Yeah. So the mom and dad think they're nuts. There's something wrong with them. Their friends leave because they're acting strange. They think they're possessed. The mom and dad eventually drag them into the psychiatrist, and exactly what the voices are telling them happens. You know, they get full of medications, or they get sent off to a psychiatric ward. All right? So it's exactly what the voices told them would happen. So they're very guarded about talking about these things. So it took a long while just to find a few things about the voices. So I found the more I knew about them and could tell these patients, the less resistant they were to tell me more information. Yeah. So one of the first things I saw is that they started running patterns. Okay, and these patterns were, number one, the first pattern I found is that virtually everything these voices said to the patients was negative. It was negative, insulting, berating, awful. You know, just awful stuff. If it was negative or positive, they used it to turn around at some later point and stab the patient in the back with it. So they were consistently negative and abusive and nasty. And that didn't vary. So I started asking dozens of patients about, you know, what these things were saying. They were all saying the same thing. It looked like they were all these voices were made in some cosmic cookie cutter somewhere with the same script. You know, you're no good, you're ugly, you're stupid, you're nasty, nobody loves you, your parents really don't like you, why don't you just go ahead and kill yourself? All right? The same script in virtually all of these. And I found that interesting. And it was a pattern that was very consistent. It didn't vary among dozens and dozens of these schizophrenic individuals. So I got to wondering, like, what is it that holds them onto such a consistent pattern? Why aren't they random like hallucinations? Why aren't they all over the place? Why aren't some negative, some neutral, some positive, like real hallucinations? You know, why are they consistently negative? Right. So that was the first pattern. The second pattern emerged again at the state hospital when one patient came in one day and he said, the voices came and I started praying the 23rd Psalm. And I said, well, that's interesting. What happened? He said they reacted like worms thrown on a hot frying pan. And I found that interesting. So I got the 23rd Psalm and I started handing it out to some of my other schizophrenic patients who were hearing voices. And I'd tell them, when the voices come, read this Psalm and tell me what happened. Consistently, the voices reacted against the psalm. They hated it. They demanded that they stop speaking it. They reacted very viciously toward that psalm. Then I found out that they also reacted negatively when the patient started reading the Bible or if they went to church. And I found, I did a little study on that, and I found if the voices were very weak and the patient went to church, they shut up. If they were medium strength, then voices would get louder and try to drown out the preacher so the patient couldn't hear what he was saying. So they would interfere with the sermon. And if they were very strong, they would drive the patient right out of the church. I mean, he would just get up and run. Okay.
Jerry, were you able to determine when the thoughts turned into voices? And is that something that's significant in your research?
Well, that is significant. And there's a story behind this too, is I was wondering, you know, what these voices sounded like. You know, were they different? Were they the same? What they were like? So I prayed one day, hey, Lord, let me experience these voices. You know, what are they like? nothing happened for about 2 weeks. All right. And what would happen is after I did, you know, a shift at the state hospital, I would come home. I lived on a lake back then, and I was a good swimmer. I loved the water. You know, it's like a fish in the water. And every night I'd go out around sunset when the motorboats would disappear from the lake, and I'd go swimming. And I was a good swimmer, and I'd hit my stroke, and I'm just heading out, and it turned into like a meditation. You know, I was balanced my air intake with the amount of energy I was putting out, and I was just cutting through the water. And after a while, I got tired, and I go, I wonder where I'm at. You know, so I looked up, and I was far from shore. And it was around sunset. I'm looking, and I was too tired to make it back to the shore, but I wasn't worried about it. By then, I was a trained scuba diver. I went through a half of a semester of skin diving and a semester of scuba diving, and it was serious training. It wasn't like the stuff they do now. I could do the dead man's float, where you put your hands behind your back, and you're just floating on top of the water, and then when you run out of air, you bring your head up and blow the air out, and suddenly you start sinking immediately. Before you go underwater, you fill your lungs with air, and then you still sink down 2 or 3 feet, and then you pop back up into the dead man's position again. So it requires very little energy. You could do it for days if you had to, if you didn't freeze to death in the water. And this water I was in that day was bath warm water. As I, the first time I did that, this thought comes into my head, and it sounded just like my normal thoughts. And it was going, the sun's going down, and it's getting dark. I don't, yeah, so what? Okay, I see it, you know. And it says, you're too far from shore to make it back right now. And I went, yeah, so what? You know, it wasn't even a concern. It wasn't even on my mind at all. I wasn't worried about it at all, you know. And then it said, you know, you were headed toward the bottom. As you know, when I left the when I let the air out, you sunk down 2 or 3 feet, and then you popped back up. All those were true, you know, but none of them were a concern. And then it comes in with, and you're going to drown. And I'm like, where in the blazes did that come from? Because it wasn't on my mind at all. I wasn't the least bit worried about drowning. Okay? Well, that's weird. And it sounded just like my regular thoughts. You know, it wasn't any different. It sounded just like the thousands of thoughts that go through my mind in a day. To tell me that I'm going to drown? You know, I'd been in much worse situations, scuba diving, than that. And I never had a voice tell me I was going to drown. Yeah. So here I am doing that, the dead man's float. And I come up again, and it says the same things again. And I realized it was a yes set. So it was saying three things that were yes. And then it was trying to tell me like I was going to drown because of these three things were correct. So it's like a vacuum cleaner salesman coming into your house and going, oh, look how good this vacuum picks up stuff. Doesn't it do a great job? Yeah. Well, it's really economical, and it cleans floors with you. Yeah, it does. So the three truisms. And then you want to buy it, don't you? Okay. It's what they call a psychological yes set. So I'm like, why am I doing a yes set on myself, telling myself I'm going to drown? It doesn't make any sense, you know? So third time I go down, and this time I let air out instead of coming to the surface. I let air out, and I started sinking, right? And then you hit what they call the crush depth, where your lungs are so compressed that you start sinking fast. You know, you're no longer buoyant. And I started sinking very fast. And because this was so strange, when I started sinking very fast, I started heading to the surface again. But before I even got there, I knew what it was. So I come up, and here's this voice in my head again. Oh, the sun's going down. You're going to get disoriented. You won't be able to see the shore. You're too tired to make it back to the shore. And you were sinking toward the bottom, and you're panicking. I wasn't panicking, you know. But here's another yes set. I'm like, what is this thing? Yeah. So I went down again, let air out, hit the crush depth, kept proceeding down toward the bottom, equalizing the pressure of my ears and as I went down. And then I felt this coldness, I mean, just a stark coldness coming up my legs. and shot for the surface again. Even before I got to the surface, I knew what it was. It was a thermocline. It's usually a layer of cold water that sinks down toward the bottom and rests on the bottom of whatever you're at, the ocean, the lake. So I knew what it was before I got to the surface. And when I got to the surface, here's this thing coming in again. You know, it's getting dark. The lights are going out on the shore. You're going to get disoriented. You're too tired to make it back to the shore. And you're panicking. And I'm like, what the hell is this thing? You know, so I defied it again. Went down, you know, went through the thermocline. And what surprised me was there was bath warm water under the thermocline. So I proceeded through the thermocline, still headed toward the bottom. I don't know how deep it was, maybe 35, 40 feet. And all of a sudden, I felt this icky stuff moving up my legs and shot for the surface again. Even before I got to the surface, I knew what it was. It was muck at the bottom of the lake. But I wasn't expecting mud. I was expecting rock, because as far out as I could reach from my house, it was all rock. So I thought the whole bottom was rock. So I come up again, and this time it says the same stuff. Okay, lights are going out on the shore. You can see them going out. There's not as many as there were. You're still too tired to make it back, and you're panicking. Because, you know, I was a little shook up when that ooky stuff started crawling up my leg. And this thing says, and there's a motorboat heading right for you, and it's going to cut you to pieces because it can't see you. So I turn to my left, and I look, and sure enough, there's a motorboat there. I can see the green light on there, and it's heading right for me in the distance. And I didn't hear it underwater, and I was surprised that I didn't, because you can hear sound a long distance underwater, a lot further than you can hear in the air. And I'm watching this motorboat come for me, and here's this voice in my head saying, they can't see you. They're going to hit you. They're going to knock you cold, and then you're going to be ground to pieces by the propeller. I wasn't worried about it, because I had to dive below motorboats before when I was scuba diving and just hug the bottom until they went over. Right? So I didn't want to do that, but if I had to, I knew I could. So I'm watching this thing come, and it passes by maybe 50 feet from me. Right? And I'm watching it go past, and this big wave comes from the wake just as I'm taking in a breath of air, because I wasn't paying any attention to the wake. And I go to turn around. It hits me right in the face as I'm sucking in a breath of air. So I took some water in my mouth. I spit it out and started coughing. This thing right away. It's like, you're going to drown. You're going to drown. You know, da da da. And I'm like, what the frick is this thing? So I headed for the bottom again. Went through the thermocline. Stuck my feet stuck in the mud. And I kind of rolled over just like I was a dead man on the bottom of the lake with my knuckles like 6 inches above the muck. And I was just laying there on the bottom. And I was kind of scared because this thing was very weird. And I was waiting for something to come out of the blackness because it was pitch black down there. It was nighttime. I was at the bottom of the lake, 35 feet down, nighttime, stuck in the mud like a dead man. Okay, just floating above the water as if I had drowned. Okay. And this thing didn't come while I was underwater. So I still had maybe 15, 20 seconds of air left before I ran out. And I'm just laying there. And I became aware that I was aware. And that's it. There were no thoughts. All my feelings were cut off. The water was bath warm, you know. So I wasn't breathing. I wasn't thinking. I wasn't feeling, I wasn't tasting, I wasn't seeing. All my senses were cut off. And all that I was aware of is I'm aware that I'm aware. And I realized that that's what's there. When you take away all the senses and all the sensory input that we're constantly being bombarded with constantly, that's what's there. An awareness that you're aware. And I headed toward the surface, and it was just like an amazing insight. I'd actually experienced it. You know, the water was bath warm, so I wasn't feeling the water even. I wasn't hearing. Everything was shut down. I got to the surface, and that thing didn't say another word. It was gone. And I didn't realize what it was until months later when I realized that was the voices. That's what they sound like. They don't sound like, we're the voices, and you're no good, and you're rotten, and you're evil, and everybody hates you, and you're disgusting. It sounds just like the regular thoughts that go through your head on a regular day, but the intent is very different.
It sounds like it mimicked a sensory deprivation tank.
Yes, it was. It was a sensory deprivation tank. There was no sensory input at all.
Given that scenario, is this possible treatment for this condition?
Well, it's a necessary knowledge. See, schizophrenics don't know. See, they're told by the psychiatric mafia that these voices are hallucinations, that they belong to you, that they're your voices, that your mind has turned on you, which is most of the most devastating thing that they could be told. It's a very diabolical thing to tell somebody like that. Those thoughts don't come from their minds, okay? They come from outside their minds, okay? They don't belong to them. Now, they have a very hard time discriminating between their thoughts and the voices because they sound exactly alike, except the intent is very different. The intent is negative. It's destructive. You know, it's abusive. Right? So they need to understand that those voices that they're hearing don't come from them. And it's not just them that hears those voices. We all do. You know, we all get intrusive thoughts from time to time. You know, I had one guy who listened to one of my lectures write me back, and he goes, "Yeah, I know what you're talking. I was standing behind my boss the other day, and this voice came into my head and told me to spit on the back of his neck." I went, "Yeah, he's got it." Once they understand that these voices are not them, then they can split them off and say, "Well, I got an enemy. I got to fight against this thing." Otherwise, they're the enemy. And what psychiatry and the big pharma are telling them is that you've gone crazy. Your brain is broken. You have a chemical imbalance in your brain. All of those are lies. All for their benefit, not for the benefit of the patients.
That's a very critical point right there. Because when people begin to understand and learn about the etheric parasites, these voices, especially those people, maybe they don't have schizophrenia, but they have a chronic anxiety or negative thinking loops.
Yes.
And they're told these thoughts, like you pointed out, they're coming from them, and it's they're broken. When you do understand those thoughts aren't yours, it could make it easier to doubt them and objectify them.
Right. You've got it really hit right on the head. That's the number one thing a schizophrenic needs to do. And people that have obsessive compulsive disorders, to realize that those thoughts are not theirs, that they're being put into their thought stream by these negative entities. Okay? These things are energetic and they're parasites. And the reason they're doing that is because they want to upset the person to generate negative emotional energy, which is what they feed off of.
Now, that's an interesting area, too, because I was thinking about this element as well. It's understood that disembodied etheric parasite can interact with the human victim and cause the person to perceive thoughts that would cause negative emotional response. And that response is somehow a food source. And this is not unlike the complex nature of the liver fluke, a flatworm that takes over the brain of an ant and causing the ant to cling to the top of a blade of grass where they can be eaten by cattle or deer. The ant is placed up there during grazing hours of the cool morning or evening. It's very specific. The intelligence is incredible. Would you talk about any advancement in learning about these parasites or entities? Because the description is vague. Is it a disembodied human or is it a demon?
A lot of them are, you know, but they're demonic in nature. So they've been taking over. So there's 23 patterns I found that these things run, you know, and they're consistent, persistent patterns. Now you can, I'll see if I can find a few of them here, but you can go to my website at jerrymarzynski.com and then go to articles. And under articles, there's a list of patterns. Okay. And these patterns are the operational definition of these voices. Okay. And, you know, like the first one that I said, they're negative. They're consistently negative. They're anti-religious. You know, so why would a hallucination be anti-religious? And why would it care? They are parasites. So I did a study on the schizophrenics I was working with, and I've said, how much energy do you have before the voices come? And how much energy do you have after the voices come? I did a 1 to 10 scale on those things. And it turned out that it was statistically significant. They had much less energy after the voices came.
So it's your standard energy vampire effect also occurring here as well.
Yeah. Okay, here's the list of patterns. So, you know, there's a number of articles on my website at jerrymarzynski.com, but this is the operational definition of these entities. They're negative. They're anti-religious. They foster and create negative emotion. This is what they feed off of. Once they create that negative emotion, then they energetically drain their victims. And I talked to scores of schizophrenics who said, how much energy do you have before the voices come, and how much energy do you have after the voices come? There was always a significant drop in their perceived level of energy after the voices attacked them. And this was consistent. You know, now they didn't realize that until I brought it up. And my last 10 years, I worked psych crisis in major hospital emergency rooms around Tucson. And I was thinking, what can I tell these people that would help them? Because they didn't want you working with people in the emergency room. They wanted you to get them out. That was it. Somehow get them out of there and don't spend any time working with them or trying to get them better. All right. So the two things I could tell them is that these things were negative, they were anti-religious, and that they were parasites. So the other patterns is they get louder after sunset, which is weird. You know, they get loudest between 3 and 4 in the morning. They get louder when ignored, so you can't ignore them. So I've heard psychiatrists tell them over and over again, oh, they're just hallucinations, just ignore them. No, doesn't work that way. They get louder. They will not be ignored. They get more persistent. They foster self-destructive behavior. They tell the patient to do things that are going to get them in trouble, that are going to destroy their way of life, and even tell them to kill themselves. And you'd wonder, like, why would they tell them to kill their food source? Well, what happens is that if somebody commits suicide, the rest of the family suffers greatly. You know, and then they start blaming themselves. Oh, I should have caught this, or I should have known better, or I should have done something, or it's my fault. So now they affect the entire family. Okay? So they foster isolation. The voices tell them, go lock yourself in the room, get away from everybody, listen to acid rock, and just listen to us. So they want to cut them off from other people. That's the worst thing you could do with a schizophrenic is to let them isolate themselves.
So they just keep working that person over until...
Just keep working that person over.
There's a schizophrenic person that sits on a bench near a trailhead here, and I do see him talking to somebody, arguing actually with something. And this is before I really saw your work, and I suggested to ignore the voices. Don't engage. But is that even possible for some of these people?
That's very difficult to do. Now, Sherry Sweeney, my co-author on our book, An Amazing Journey Through the Psychotic Mind, so for sale on Amazon, it tells how we got to this, how we got to the point where we realized that these things were entities and not hallucinations. What Sherry found and what saved her is she found, and I agree with her 100%, that these things are consummate liars. The voices lie about everything. You can't believe anything they say. You know, and even if they tell you a truth, you don't know if it's truth or not. Okay, what Sherry came up with was that's a lie program. So what she would do is she would just repeat, that's a lie, that's a lie, when they tell her, well, you're stupid. She goes, that's a lie. Well, you're ugly. That's a lie. You know, nobody likes you. That's a lie. Yeah. So What they got to do is they got to get you to believe the crap that they're telling the person in order to generate that negative emotional energy. If they don't believe it, then they won't generate that energy. Okay? Kind of short-circuiting them right at that level.
Gotcha. Yes. And the people that are targeted really heavily and they really work on relentlessly, I think you mentioned in your book they're emotionally damaged or maybe experienced a lot of trauma, but that's probably not exclusive. There are probably other reasons as well. Would you please talk about that?
Yeah, I would say the majority of them. So these are very low vibrational entities. They're very low vibrating entities. They're very nasty entities. So they're attracted to that same frequency. You know, so Tesla talked about, you know, frequency and vibrations, and this is all frequency. Most all of the schizophrenics that I worked with had somehow been either physically, emotionally, or sexually abused very badly. Okay? So they were already wounded. Okay? So these things are like sharks in an ocean. They smell blood. They smell that negative energy, and they'll move toward it. You know, and then they'll intensify it. It's like it's a lot easier to keep a wagon rolling, keep it moving, than it is to start it. So they've already got to start with somebody who's wounded. They're already at a low frequency. And they just come and pour gasoline on the fire. So those of you who are hearing voices out there or who are obsessive compulsive, go to my website at jerrymarcinski.com. Then go to articles and look up the That's a Lie program. Put it to use consistently.
Thank you, Jerry, for mentioning that, because that is one of the main treatments that is suggested in that book. So it's countering what the voices are saying immediately. There's another method that we'll talk about in a little bit called the MACE, M-A-C-E method.
That's the only psychotherapy that I've ever seen actually work. I mean, it actually gets to the core of the problem and it will get rid of it. So you have two things going on. You have what we call a negative identity. So that's where the person has gone through a trauma and makes a decision about themselves during that trauma, and that decision is negative. And they carry that decision with them the rest of their lives. Right? That's one thing that kind of is like a computer program that runs in your mind. It's consistently negative because you don't make good decisions when you're in a traumatic state. Your decision will match the state you're in. And in a traumatic state, you're in a negative state. So something happens to the person and the person might decide, well, I'm worthless. Okay, and that decision goes with them for the rest of their life. The MACE energy method will get in there and it will remove that negative identity. And these entities feed off of that negative identity. So it will remove the food source for these negative entities. And sometimes it will actually remove these voices. Sometimes. You know, but it will remove the food source for them. Now, I've had times where I tried to use MACE on the voices. Sometimes they would vanish. They would disappear. Other times they would fight against it, and they would not allow the patient to follow through with the instructions they needed to follow through with in order for MACE to work. Irrespective, you know, the MACE energy method is the single most powerful. It's an energetic psychotherapy. It's not anything like traditional psychotherapy, like talk therapies. The therapist does not need to know what the trauma was. All he needs to know is where it happened. Okay? So there's more information about the MACE energy method on my website at jerrymarcinski.com also.
The person that came up with that, his name is John MACE. Is that correct?
John MACE. He wasn't a psychiatrist or a psychologist. I think he got his master's in counseling eventually, but he was a master mariner. He was a ship captain. He drove these big ships back and forth across the ocean, and he was always fascinated with how the mind worked. And he spent his entire life trying to figure that out. And finally he did, and he came up with the MACE energy method. So these entities, these voices are energy. They're energetic beings, okay? They can enter the person's mind because your mind is also energy. Your spirit is energy. Your thoughts are energy. Your memory is energy. So they can meld with your memory, and they can pull up every rotten thing you've ever done and throw it in your face. And use that to generate that negative emotional energy also. Right? So what the MACE energy method does is it removes that negative energy, that stuff that the person has done that is generating guilt or shame or fear or feelings of anxiety or worthlessness. It removes that, and it does it within an hour. It's gone, and it doesn't come back. The person is cured of that particular negative identity, right? And it's permanent. So what happens is these things don't have that stuff to feed off of anymore. So their food source, there's nothing for them to provoke. You know, there's nothing for them to, no fire for them to pour gasoline on. You know, it's gone.
I'm reluctant to share this story, but a couple of years ago, I was just waking up from a night's sleep, and I heard a voice whispering, just chattering away. I stayed motionless with my eyes closed and listened to hear the words, and it was the same screed as "you're worthless, you're ugly, you're a failure," and on, but it was whispering. It was like, "you're ugly, you're a failure, you'll amount to nothing, you'll never," and it just kept going. My reaction was to start laughing at the absurd desperation of it, and it stopped immediately. But later I was wondering how I caught this and how long that was going on. I heard this audibly. It sounded like a small being whispering, not in a full voice. Do your patients or other people have similar descriptions while waking or trying to sleep?
Yeah, well, that's what they hear when they're awake. That kind of stuff. You heard them. That was them.
So I caught them, and
you caught them.
And it's almost like the sensory deprivation experience that you had, I was thinking. But I heard them and caught them. But why at that time? What's going on? Is it always happening?
Well, yeah, they're always trying to get through, you know, but most of the time you're distracted with other stuff in your life. You know, that's why you don't want to let a schizophrenic be isolated. You know, they have a much harder time getting through if you're distracted with life tasks.
Do your patients talk about catching them like this?
Well, they hear them all the time. You know, schizophrenic, that's what they hear 24 hours a day, all their waking days, all their waking time, that's what they hear.
But I'm not schizophrenic.
No,
I mean,
not.
So what? So
everybody hears that stuff from time to time. They're trying to get through to everybody. So when you have an intrusive thought, you know, like there was one time last year. I'm in Tucson, Arizona, and most of us don't have lawns here. We just go out with a machete and cut back the cactus to keep it from overgrowing the place. So I was out with my, I have a beautiful white husky, pure white, and she was out there with me, and I had a machete there, and I'm cutting the cactus, and she runs by, and here's this thought barges into my head very clearly, and it says, "cut her head off," and I'm like, I'm shocked. I was just absolutely shocked. I had the machete in my hands, you know, and she was right there, and it was like, you know, where did that come from? It wasn't my thought, you know, but here I am standing there with a machete with a thought to kill her, you know, and she hadn't done anything. There was no provocation for it. And I was absolutely shocked that I had that thought, you know, and I knew where it came from. I knew it was them, but still it was upsetting. Normal people, they're standing on the edge of a bridge and they go, "I wonder what it would be like to jump." Or I had a preacher once told me he was standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon and he had this thought to jump, you know. or you're driving your car and you have a thought to what would it be like to drive into oncoming traffic. You know, just these obtrusive thoughts that most people would never act on. That's them.
This is fascinating to learn more dynamics about this. And it seems that we haven't zeroed in for humans to study this element, zeroed in on precisely what these things are. Okay, we got parasites, but etheric parasites, we don't know what we look like to them, I guess is what I'm saying also. Are you looking into that area of study?
What we look like to them?
Correct. Now, I notice you mentioned the gas discharge visualization camera by Konstantin Kordkov in your book. Uh-huh. He was actually a guest on the show many years ago, and we did talk about that camera and the auric field. But I'm wondering, has anybody gone further in these studies?
Well, I had one experience that might answer that is, you know, once I found these patterns, I started doing things to interfere with those patterns. So I left the state hospital after 7 years, went back to school, but went back to graduate school. And then after finished that, I ended up in Arizona, in Tucson, Arizona. And I got a job with the psychology department in the state prison. And it was what happened at the state hospital was I started asking questions to the patients. What are these things telling you? What are these voices telling you? And, you know, they would say, well, they're negative, negative. So I started asking more questions. And then one of them one day, I guess the voices got pissed off with me asking questions. And he went and told the psychiatrist, hey, this guy's asking me questions about the voices, and it makes me very uncomfortable. You know, so that next morning I got called up into the psychiatrist's office and he closed the door and he said, you will not ask these patients any questions about their voices. What you're doing is reinforcing their hallucinations and making them worse. And I went, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, what a crock of crap. You know, I already knew enough that these things, the patient wasn't getting any worse by my asking questions. Matter of fact, a lot of them were just as interested in what these things were as I was. You know, so here I was being blocked from trying to find out what these voices were and ordered not to ask these questions to schizophrenic patients. That happened twice at the state hospital. I think the psychiatrists there were afraid of these patients because they were getting assaulted by schizophrenics at a rate higher than any of the other staff there. You know, the psychiatric nurses, the psychologists, the regular nurses, the counselors, nobody was getting assaulted at the rate that psychiatrists were by schizophrenics. And that's bizarre. What's going on here? Because they were only spending 15, 20 minutes a month with these people, and it made absolutely no sense. You know, I'm going, what are they telling these people in 15 minutes that's getting them assaulted? You know, it had nothing to do, I found out later, it had nothing to do with what they were saying. It had to do with the medications. The voices didn't like the medications because it calmed the patient down. Okay, they didn't want the patient calmed down. They wanted him revved up. They wanted him paranoid. They wanted him anxious. They wanted him guilty. They wanted him ramped up as high as they could get him full to generate that negative emotion. And if they were full of major tranquilizers, they were calm. So it made their job much harder. Okay. I found that out one day questioning a patient with her mother where she was about to be discharged from the program because she had gone off her medications 3 times. And back then, we didn't have anything else except these medications to control these guys. You know, so the mother begged me, please don't discharge her. I'll come up there and we'll talk to her. We'll find out why she went off her meds. So we all got together one Friday afternoon. And her mother's begging her, why did you go off your meds? And I'm asking her, you know, this is the third time. You knew you would be discharged if you went off your meds a third time. Why did you do it? She said, you won't believe me. I told her, I've seen a lot of weird things since I've been here. You know, don't worry about that. I said, why did you do it? And she said, the voices told me that the psychiatrist was poisoning me and that I needed to go off the meds. And virtually all of the patients went off their meds at one point or another. Okay? And it clicked in my head. I said, that's why. That's why the schizophrenics are assaulting the psychiatrist, because they're telling the patient that the psychiatrist is poisoning them, and they're pointing to the nasty side effects of these medications to prove that they're being poisoned. And in fact, they are being poisoned. It's just a very slow poisoning.
It's slowing down the release of whatever the food source is in that person.
Yes.
A friend of mine, I was speaking with yesterday, I was telling him about your work, and he said, you know, my grandmother was schizophrenic. And I remember when I was very young, she was in my room looking over me one night. I woke up and there she was in my room looking at me. And he said it really frightened him. And
yes, and it should.
The voices were telling her to kill her children.
Yes.
And so she ended up leaving the family. She moved to California. She moved from Michigan to California. I think lived on a farm.
They absolutely hate children.
Why is that?
I think because children are so innocent, they can't stand it.
Do you think also that the children may be able to see them physically?
I think in some cases the children can. Schizophrenics mothers, you know, I don't think it's a genetic thing where seems to be a predisposition in the children of schizophrenics to become schizophrenic themselves. I don't think that has anything to do with a chemical imbalance or genetics. I think it has to do with the schizophrenic mother or father setting up the conditions under which these things thrive.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't quite understand it. So it's the parents
set up the mental condition in the children for these voices to thrive. You know, so they tell the children, you're no good, you're rotten, you're nasty, all the stuff that the voices are telling them. And the kids start adopting that. And that makes it easier for the voices to move over into them.
Right. So just basic verbal abuse. And the parent doesn't necessarily have to be schizophrenic. They could just be vulnerable to the voices, and then that abuse is carried through to the child.
Yes.
It's essentially an epidemic. That's going to do it for part one of the interview with Jerry Marzynski, author of the book An Amazing Journey into the Psychotic Mind, Breaking the Spell of the Ivory Tower. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.